We absolutely celebrate the great joy of anticipation when a child is on the way, the showers of gifts, the wonders of movement, getting the house ready for a whole new person. And then months later, the seeming impossibility of keeping up with laundry and getting enough sleep and just living something like a normal life. Normal with newborn is a different kind of normal. This hour's guest talks about the challenges of parenting at all ages in a modern context. Her book is All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. The author is Jennifer Senior, an award-winning journalist who writes profiles and cover stories on politics and social science as a contributing editor at New York Magazine. Her voice might sound familiar as she's a regular on the talk show circuit, appearing on NPR, PBS, and a bunch of other networks and shows. Jennifer Senior, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
You write that parents have no clue what it will mean to have their hearts permanently annexed. That's a really interesting phrase, permanently annexed. What does that mean?
Oh, my God, you're so kind of isolated. I've never, ever spoken to anybody who's homed in on it. And it was a phrase that kind of came totally naturally to me because there is a distinct before and an after. I mean, it is this singular experience to suddenly have swept into your identity and your heart this other human being, right? I mean, that like you are no longer only thinking for yourself once you are a parent, that somehow like a giant chunk of psychological real estate and emotional real estate, every part of you is now like kind of annexed by this other person. And I think that's kind of a privilege. It's also why parents worry a lot. It's why they are so vulnerable. It's why they experience so much joy and kind of transcendent awe, and why they can be absolutely crushed by sadness. You know, it's everything. It's because part of you is occupied by someone else, you know, or part of your brain and part of your heart. So to me, that was like a very natural way of kind of describing one of the most profound flicks of the switch ever.
Yeah, annexation is a good way to put it. It's a change. It's a permanent change.
Yeah, it's this permanent, it's irreversible. I mean, even if, God forbid, something happens to your child, I mean, it's irreversible. They are now of you, right? So that was just my quick way of kind of alluding to it in the introduction. But yes, annexation was exactly how I thought of it, you know?
Well, it brought back the memories of a friend who had a baby years ago and was rushing around the store one night when she had just a chance to leave the baby with her husband for a few minutes and was running around thinking, boy, I can't wait until things return to normal. And then she stopped at that. Wait, this is normal.
Yeah, exactly. And something I talk about, actually, in the book, because, of course, you know, unlike any other life transition, I mean, this one just, I mean, all transitions are, of course, you know, riotous and kind of at that moment, you know, seemingly full of, you know, chaos. But this is one for which we are utterly unprepared. It's not like marriage where you've been dating that person for a long time, or a new job where you kind of know what the terms of the job are, hopefully, and you might have trained for that job or gone to school for that job or at least gone through a program. I mean, she, you know, had no idea what was coming when that baby came along, right? So she sat there thinking, well, one day it'll, you know, go back to the way it was, and it was, and no, in fact, it never does. That was the new normal, as you say.
Right, yeah, it's moving ahead, not back. This is, you're not breaking a whole lot of new ground here, in a sense, so much as compiling things that have come before. And I want to talk about some of the starting points for examining the effect that kids have on parents. Alice Rossi apparently started this off in 1968. What did she write about?
Yeah, so she wrote this paper that I thought was tremendous called Transition to Parenthood. I have not seen anybody resume that question. I mean, I kind of wrote a book based on what she said, which is she was the only one I ever saw in the academic literature who starkly posed the question, why does no one ask about the effects that children have on their parents? Why is no one looking at this? We're all so focused on how we can affect our children, and no one is asking about how they affect us. Now, she had a very particular agenda. She wrote this in 1968, and even though she was a sociology professor, she would go on to teach at Amherst. I think that the more important piece of her biography to know is that she would also go on to be one of the co-founders of the National Organization of Women, because what really interested her in 1968 was the effect that babies had on women. Because what she was clearly doing was writing as a very bright woman in 1968 who was torn. Like, there was, you know, part of her generational cohort was putting on the pants and going into the workforce for the first time and deferring having children. And the other half were still making a beeline for the home and like creating these domestic snuggeries. And they were doing things when, like, in part, some of them actually did want to go into the workforce, but were being still told, no, you know, they should be in the home. It was kind of the Don Draper, Mad Men territory in the early part of the season. You know, women were a little conflicted about what to do. She really wanted to examine what the effects were of babies on women, because she felt like women didn't have choices once they had kids. Now, it's a very different ballgame today, but that's really the context in which she was asking the question.
But she was not the first. I mean, she actually was not quite the middle of the stream, but not the beginning of it either.
You're talking about the paper, the 1957 paper about parenthood as crisis?
Exactly, and we have to take a break. You can hear the music coming up. We'll come back and talk about parenthood as crisis or parenting as crisis when we come back from a break. We're talking to Jennifer Senior about her book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. You can join this conversation on The Exchange. Talk about your own experiences with parenthood and the expectations you might have had and how those matched up with reality once the kids were actually here. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Jennifer Senior and with your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Jennifer Senior, New York Magazine contributing editor. She is the author of a book about parenting called All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. It takes a look at a lot of societal attitudes about parenting and what we're going through in this day and time. Join us on The Exchange with your own stories and your own questions at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782, and our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So just starting to talk about the fact that Alice Rossi, who later was one of the co-founders of the National Organization for Women, wrote her piece in 1968 about the effect that kids have on parents, but there was earlier work from dating back to 1957, apparently.
Yeah. So this fellow named E.E. LeMasters wrote this, you know, very incendiary, in a way, study. You can't write a study. He did a study that wound up being quite incendiary, called Parenthood is Crisis. I think this was in 1957, so we were talking about the moment when the American nuclear family was buffed to a high shine in the popular image. I mean, it was, you know, we were all kind of worshiping at the altar of this, you know, June Cleaver model of
sure, and it was
familyhood.
The peak of the baby boom and everything, yeah.
Yeah, so exactly, right. So along comes this guy who says in a paper that kids, in fact, do not make a marriage more secure, but in fact weaken marriages. Now, this has been a finding that has been replicated hundreds of times, no exaggeration, since he did it in 1957. And his methods weren't great, by the way. He was not using state-of-the-art, you know, methodology. But it just blew everybody's minds, and people reacted very hostily within the academy to it. No one could believe that babies didn't shore up marriages. They were convinced that they were exactly what held together families. And in some senses, they were correct, because the odds of divorcing go down if you have a kid. But if you actually look at marital satisfaction levels and, you know, how frequently people fight and all that, they go way up, unfortunately. And this is one of the most robust findings in social science, that kids really do tax a marriage's strengths. There are positives for marriage, which is that they also become this joint life project. And this, I mean, it's a common bond. It's also this way of, like, infusing your marriage with new stimuli and new stuff that's constantly coming in. Your kid's coming back from school and telling you about things you didn't know. You go out to dinner and you have this, like, mutual thing to discuss always. But in terms of the day-to-day stuff, it's very hard. And he was the first one to point it out, which, as I said, was this, you know, revolutionary act. So that was interesting.
Well, it's an interesting thing to consider, though, that on those two levels, though. I mean, the time levels, that, you know, the day-to-day, you know, oh, my God, you know, dirty diapers and toys all over the floor and things like that. But the long-term view, then, yes, you do get your life enriched by having kids around. But there's still, it must have been incredible heresy to talk about, you know, hey, you know, kids can be hard on a marriage. In 1957, especially.
Yeah, well, and what's even more interesting is that I think even academics revolted when it came out. You know, I mean, it'd be one thing for the public to dislike the paper, mm-hmm. but you know, for people who are supposed to be interested only in kind of neutral, you know, you would think that if, in the spirit of academic inquiry, you would want to find whatever you found, and that would be that. But apparently his colleagues also had a very dim view of this paper, which is funny.
Well, and then, you know, even years later, it was heresy to say things like, you know, kids are a pain, or like Ayelet Waldman said in 2005, she loves her husband more than her kids, and the whole world just kind of blew up in front of her, and she ended up on Oprah's show and everything. How much of this whole backdrop was in your head when you had your child in 2008?
Not that much. I mean, you know, I think you either want a kid or you don't. You know, I really wanted a child. I didn't have any of that noise in my head. I think sometimes these things get blown out of proportion by my own colleagues, our colleagues in the media. I was much more interested in some of the social science that I had read earlier. In Dan Gilbert's book, Stumbling on Happiness, I had come across this one, you know, just a stray couple of pages that had mentioned the literature that very, you know, consistently seems to suggest that kids do not improve your happiness, that they might even compromise it. I read that in 2006, and I still very much wanted a kid in 2008. It didn't make any difference to me what social science said. I was much more interested in why it was there. But I think that, like, having a kind of dispassionate, analytical, you know, interest in these questions, you know, is different from, like, that deep kind of yearning in your gut to want a baby, you know, and want to nurture someone. So I'm going to just say very honestly that the cultural noise did not go, wasn't like racing around in my head at all. I mean, I'll tell you one way that it was. Whenever women have kids now, you know, they walk into Barnes & Noble and they are suddenly staring at these bookshelves that are just massive, telling them what to do and how to raise a child. And that kind of stuff is unavoidable. And there was some part of me that really chafed at all that stuff, that went, why on earth do I need to read like 20 books about something that human beings have been doing successfully, for millennia with no help at all, with no books at all, with only folk wisdom to guide them or whatever instincts they may have? Like, this is that part of me was quite alert and quite put off. You know, I did have this kind of conscious distaste for what I, you know, all the things I was being told to do and all the baby culture. But in terms of all the noise about, you know, I love my husband more than my kid, I love my kids less than that, I mean, I none of that was really in my head.
You leave the introduction with three things to think about through the book. That number one, that parenting is hard always, that our work lives are more complex now, and that childhood has been redefined. How do you think it's been redefined, Jennifer?
I don't think it's me. You know, I don't think that it's been redefined. I mean, I think that historically one can make a very solid case that it has been redefined in America, and that the turning point was after World War II. This was sort of a revelation to me, but once you start reading about the history of American childhood, suddenly your own experience as a parent becomes reframed for you very quickly in this way that's actually quite useful. All you really need to know is this. Until the Progressive Era, so let's say between 1890 and 1920, kids worked. This was not ethical. This was not moral. This is not desirable, but it's what it was. Kids were economic assets in families. And in general, the more children you had, the more prosperous you were. There were certain exceptions, but this was generally the rule. And they worked primarily on farms. They also worked in more Dickensian contexts, like in factories and in mills and in mines. And during the Progressive Era, we realized that this was terrible and, you know, that this was a completely wretched arrangement, and we banned it. And there were exceptions always, particularly to farm work. But this was how it was. Then in the 1930s, you know, the American economy fell apart and no one was working very much. And in the 1940s, our boys were, you know, fighting, so kids were working a little bit again. But by 1945, and particularly in the 50s, that's when the American sheltered, education-focused childhood truly began. And here's what happened. Rather than kids working for us, we started working for our children. We started giving them allowances. We started giving them our money. It started to cost money to raise them because increasingly kids were not only going to high school, but they were going to college, and that was immensely expensive. In the 50s, there wasn't that much income inequality, so having like a person to shelter at home all the time or several kids to shelter at home all the time wasn't that big a deal because, you know, America wasn't that competitive a place. And we were reasonably prosperous. But by the 1970s, when wages started to stagnate, it was a very big deal. And by the 80s and 90s, as, you know, the economy started to globalize, it was an even bigger deal because suddenly we had to raise super children. We had to cultivate our kids within an inch of their lives if we wanted them to have the same lives that we do, if we wanted them to have the same middle-class opportunities. So now we are at this unbelievably interesting moment where American mothers spend more time with their children than they did in 1965. And in 1965, most moms were not in the workforce, but they were not spending tons of time with their kids. What they were doing was keeping immaculate homes. They were, you know, making splendid meals. They were cleaning their houses. Today, if you look at American time use survey data, our houses are filthy. No one is cleaning their houses. But everyone is spending tons of time with their kids, driving them all over creation for, you know, extracurriculars, checking their homework, reading to them at night, having them sleep in bed with them. You know, I mean, it's everything. So,
is it a slight percentage more? I mean, how much more time are women spending with their kids than they did in 1965?
About 4 or 5 more hours a week.
Really?
I don't know, and that's 2008 data. I'm sure it's more now. Mm-hmm. It's only been on an upward trajectory. But that's, remember, these are aggregate totals, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, so these are overall averages, rather. But you have to imagine, I mean, we know that, middle-class women and upper-middle-class women spend even more time with their kids and do even more, extracurricular activities than those who haven't gone to college. You know, they enroll them in more stuff and then therefore spend more time, like, driving them around. So, I mean, you know, there are distortions probably among the middle-class and upper-middle-class.
Jennifer Senior is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we discuss parenthood in today's world and what's happened to it and what's happened to us. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Jacob in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jennifer Senior.
I want to ask the stupidest question you could ask to a pregnant couple. Okay? And they almost never, they're really surprised that you ask it. It's almost an insult. Okay, but the question is, how much is a baby that's newborn going to cost you to raise it to, let's say, 20 or let's say to college? Okay, and we already know the most. If we want to be happy, money is part of that equation. You kind of have to ask these questions. If you get a job, you always ask, how much am I going to be paid? If you get to buy a home, you also ask, how much is this house going to cost? If you buy a car, you really want to know how much it's going to cost, because that's essential. You get a baby, you throw everything out the window. You throw any calculations out the window. We know, for instance, I ask people this question, and it's very surprising because some of them say, this baby's going to cost you nothing, you know, literally nothing, because, you know, I'm going to raise it at home, and it's going to go to public school, and, my parents are going to be babysitting it, and the government's going to pay me to, you know, feed this kid, you know. And then mm-hmm. other people, they say, oh, it's going to cost like $1,000 a year. And some people say $10,000. Literally, very few people know that it's probably going to cost over $500,000, you know, to raise it completely, and you take away, you know, your lost productivity and lost jobs and lost opportunity and everything else.
Well, it ends up being more than $1.
Probably over $1 million for some kids in big, rich city.
I actually have numbers for you if you're interested.
Okay, let's go with that. Yeah, thanks, Jacob.
Yeah, and thanks for the call. It's very interesting you say this. The U.S. Department of Agriculture actually does this calculation, how much it will cost per child how much it costs to raise a child. And they don't include college. But the most recent figures that they've got is that a child born in 2010 will cost a middle-income family almost $300,000 to raise. That's not including college tuition, which, as we know, the rates of which are, you know, rising.
A big chunk,
you know,
on top of that, yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, but also they're exceeding the pace of inflation, mm-hmm. right? So, and it's a big chunk on top, depends on if you do a state school or a private school, but either way, you're looking at an additional, you know, at least $100,000 on top of that. So if you're raising a middle-class child, it's $300,000. If it's a high-income kid, if they're born in a high-income home, it's close to $500,000. And if it's low-income, it's about $212,000. This is for one child born in 2010. So actually, that's funny. That $500,000 figure that he gave is about right for the middle class if you throw in college expenses. It might be slightly less, and that's per child. And it's without college expenses if you're talking about an upper-middle-class kid.
Are there economies of scale? I don't mean to be facetious here, but I mean...
I'm sure there are. I'm sure that that's right. I don't know whether they've done anything that granular. I'm going to guess that they haven't.
Right. Well, the hand-me-down clothes and stuff probably wouldn't save you that much, I guess.
I was just going to say, I'm not sure that those are where the biggest expenses lay. But, you know, I mean, leftover food. I mean, it's got to be something, you mm-hmm. know. And I think that also expenses are disproportionately spread. I mean, you know, diapers are an extraordinary expense that people don't realize. But, you know, I don't know how they're, you know, distributed, because I think extracurricular activities are, you know, cost a lot of money. And I think that that's why there's such a big difference between middle class and upper middle class kids. I think a lot of that we can assume are like the violin, you know, maybe private school costs. I don't know.
Right. Jennifer Senior is our guest on The Exchange. Her book is All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. The book's first chapter is about autonomy and people losing that autonomy as human beings because they've had these kids who are now annexing them, as you pointed out earlier. I'm curious about these studies about lost sleep and some of the impacts here. I mean, it's a little more serious than just I'm tired, right?
Yeah, and I think people don't necessarily know that going in, just that there's a difference between isolated evenings or nights of sleep deprivation and sustained sleep deprivation. And what's interesting to me is that there isn't even a particularly robust literature on sleep deprivation in parents, because if you think about it, it would be kind of cruel and inhuman to design a study where you kind of pull people away from their kids, or I mean, it's already hard enough. So to actually get people to keep sleep logs on top of that is hard to do. Most sleep deprivation studies are done on college students. A lot of studies are done on college students because they're nearby for academics.
Sure.
But right. So you're not going to get like tons of people raising their hands for this. But from as best as we can tell, if you just want to look generally at sleep deprivation studies on adults, it looks pretty bad. If you, for several nights in a row, get only about 4 hours of sleep, you are basically functioning at the level of someone who is legally drunk. So figure yourself compromised thusly. That's how you're compromised. And that's not great. I mean, you're losing a lot of wattage if you do that. Also, you know, the emotional effects of sustained sleep deprivation aren't great. And a fella did, you know, a really nice kind of comprehensive study looking at groups of people and figured that the population sort of fell into thirds. A third handled it okay in the short haul. Nobody handled it well in the long term. But a third were, like, able to be fairly self-regulating and not lose their cool. A third lost their cool fairly rapidly. And a third lost their cool almost immediately. Like, you know, you deprive them of sleep and they really can't handle it. And I was like that. I mean, just a couple of nights and I was in very poor shape. You know, I got very sad very quickly, you know, felt myself to be very irritable. You know, and it's a bummer for new parents, you know, because you're chastising yourself all day long for not being under, you know, not having your kind of your emotions under control, because you want them under control. And parents are extremely hard on themselves when they lose their tempers or lose their, you know, even raise their voices or...
I should point out the book is not just studies and reports and psychological experiments and things like that. I mean, there are some truly lovely case studies of, and particularly including parent-child moments here. But you say these are somewhat rare. I mean, flow is an issue in the book. What do you mean by flow in this context?
Oh, okay. I was going to say the case studies are everywhere. My whole book is driven by case studies. You're talking about those moments of joy that are rare, or
right.
Those moments of, I mean, there are lots of moments of joy, I think. In the early years, I talk about flow being elusive, and flow is different. So, you know, flow is coined by this Hungarian psychologist, Mike Csikszentmihalyi. It's the state of being in the zone. I hear the music coming on. But just think of an athlete who's sinking every basketball shot. You know, mm-hmm. That's being in the zone. And it's hard to do that when you've got a kid who's nagging you all the time. You know, and when kids are little, they are. You can't remain focused and get ahead of steam going. So I talk about the elusiveness of flow in the early years. It comes back.
And thanks for pronouncing the name for us. Mike Csikszentmihalyi. I've been looking at the name for a couple of weeks and a couple of books and trying to figure it out. So we'll get back to that pronunciation with Jennifer Senior. Her book is All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Back with her and your phone calls on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Jennifer Senior, award-winning journalist who's working as a contributing editor for the New York Magazine. She is the author of a book on parenting called All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. You can join this discussion on the Jefferson Exchange as we go through this. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. And there's a description in the book, Jennifer, about one of the women that you follow around here. And it points out how this really is kind of a two-sided coin with joy and fun. In the sense that, for example, you can just get so much out of watching your child discover things that the child has to learn to be able to get along in the world. But at the same time, you also have to be there while your child has to learn all these things that you know and have known instinctively for a long, long time. And so there's the sense of like, oh, this is great. They're learning things new. But, oh, my God, they're learning. I have to teach. Everything has to happen here. They're not learning this stuff. You know, don't jump off the couch because you'll hurt yourself. Things like that.
Right, it's true. I mean, things that we think are implicit knowledge turned out to be learned, you know, like not stepping off a couch, right, if you're an 18-month-old. It's true, and so that is exactly it. You can kind of see in that sort of example, or I'll give a better one, actually. Here's like a really good example, I think, of how parenting can be both like stressful and sublime, right? So, you know, think about how many times parents are nagging their children to be polite, right? You know, and it's your responsibility to make sure that they know how to be polite and that they know how to do the right thing and say the right thing in the right context and not to offend anyone. So you're constantly badgering them about this. This is not fun. And then one day your kid turns around and does something unbelievably sweet to another child. Like they're very generous, they're very compassionate, they're small and they do this, or they're bigger and they do this. And you witness them do this. You witness a small kid, you know, like hug another small kid who's been hurt. Or you hear your teenager talk about how they tactfully refrain from talking about a party that they were invited to that their friend was not. And that is like that's a transcendent, amazing moment in parenting, because your heart is just like buckling with pride. Like you have done the most amazing thing in raising this moral, compassionate creature, and you can't believe they came from you. The pride is indescribable. But all of those nagging moments that got you there, I mean, oh my God, that was just like a terrible march of a, you know, and you're singled out for being, you know, really annoying while you're doing all that stuff. You know, you don't feel good being the bad cop as you're telling them. But then there's this moment where your kid, it's all worked. You were witnessing their compassion in real time. And that's indescribable. It really is. I've seen it with my own kid. And it was one of the kind of consistent stories that I'd get from other parents, like, tell me about the good stuff. A lot of them would talk about this miraculous, sudden, you know, evincing of, you know, evidence of compassion in their children. Which I just love.
A real they're getting it kind of moment.
Yeah.
Let's take a call from Pam and Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jennifer Senior. Her book is All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood.
Hi. Well, I don't have any kids, as fate would have it for me, and I love kids. I'm a preschool teacher, and I don't want to make the case for not having children. As you guys talked about earlier, the cost of raising a child, I'd like to talk about the environmental cost of having a child, especially in developed countries such as ours. And with 7 billion people on the planet and growing, and we have climate change, species extinction, and, you know, you mentioned driving your kids all over the place. I think that people who do have kids have a responsibility to raise conscious children and empathetic. You know, you have to teach empathy to a child. But also on how we consume and how we live our lives. And I make the case for being a, I know it's a biological urge to have children, but I recently was with my niece who's in her 30s and asked her what her driving passion was, and all she could think of was, I want to have kids. And I just think that we need to refocus and maybe take care of the kids who are already alive, be a good aunt, be a mentor, be a teacher, adopt. But we really don't need a whole lot more people on this planet. And the way we're, we have this unconscious consumption. And, oh, yeah, we got to drive our kids here and drive our kids there. Why can't we just have neighborhood groups playing games together and get back to more sustainable ways of raising our children? Because, let's face it, folks, it's not, I actually kind of feel sorry for the kids who are being born today because the future doesn't look so bright. And I've been involved in a lot of different activist groups, and they're always like, well, where are the women? I'm like, well, they're busy at home with the kids, cooking dinner, cleaning the house, getting the kids with their homework. And then you see the women start emerging in their 50s at these meetings because their kids have grown up. So I just want to question having kids. And if you do have children, why not adopt? Why do we have to make more people on this planet? Now I'll listen on the air.
All right. Thanks for that, Pam. Appreciate it. Jennifer, your thoughts?
Well, I think that people who don't want kids should not have kids, and I think the people who do should. I mean, I don't really have, like, a dog in that race. I think that there are people who are, like, incredibly clear on their instincts one way or the other, and there are some people who sort of are on the fence, and they figure it out as they go, and they make choices depending on their partners. But for people who don't want kids, there are a million ways to contribute to the world and to have meaning and transcendent moments. And for people who want children, I think they should go and have them. In terms of environmental impacts and all that stuff, you know, I hear what she's saying. I think that there are many ways to talk about this question, and I wouldn't want to quite oversimplify it. If all of us stopped having children, then your caller wouldn't have a doctor to take care of her when she's older. I mean, the next generation, we need another generation of people to come along and do all the things that societies do. And you are dependent at a certain point on a younger generation when you're older to be around for you. And so, you know, and in Europe, you know, there's a huge population crisis in some countries. And there are some cultures in Europe that I don't want to see disappear. And I want those cultures to sustain, and I want people to be there. I think that there are ways to live more responsibly through policies and things, you know, that are, you know, through, I think that one could just as easily make the case that, you know, a new generation of children might be the ones to actually enact better, you know, environmental policies and environmental change because they'll have higher stakes, you know, in these questions. So I'm not prepared to say, like, no, stop having kids. I think that people who want them should have them and people who don't shouldn't. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have a very, like, I don't really have, like, a firm philosophy about this one way or the other.
All right. I want to come back to a couple of concepts in the book that that we sort of touched on briefly, and we can expand a bit. One is cultivation of kids. The other one is marriage, though. I want to get to that one first. It comes earlier in the book. Obviously, there is an effect on the marriage that we've already documented a bit in this discussion. But why don't we just go straight to one of the hearts of things for men, certainly. I mean, how big an impact does parenthood have on sex and romance in a marriage?
You know, as I wrote in my book, it is surprisingly under-researched in terms, like, the sex part is, which I found fascinating. I mean, there's lots of data out there about, you know, married couples and sex, although, frankly, it's very hard to know how to read it because, number one, you don't know how many people are lying, and number two, no one looks at the length of the marriage, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There is plenty of data that suggests that the big drop-off point in sex in a marriage is after the first year. That's regardless of whether or not a kid comes along.
Really? With or without a child?
with or without.
Wow.
That after year one, there's a very steep plunge. So it has nothing to do with whether there are children there. So that's the honeymoon period in terms of sex, and then it all, like, you know, starts to dip. So it's really hard to find, like, a study that actually strings apart children from other variables, because there are lots of other things going on once you've got kids. You've got very complex, you know, like, you know, you've got work going on. It depends on how old you are. Weirdly, most of the studies that I saw just looked at kind of sex postpartum, which is a whole other thing. That's just about, like, a woman's body healing. And there were some studies that looked at, like, the difference of, you know, how much sex couples were having before kids versus after for about a year out. But, again, couples might have been having more sex before the kid because they wanted to get pregnant, you know. So it's, I mean, I'm amazed, actually, at how poorly designed a lot of these things were and how sparse they were. So I think that, you know, what one can safely say is that there is this triangulation that goes on. I mean, once a kid comes along, you are now kind of devoting your energies both to the child and to your spouse, right? And so one hears, the best that I could do was sort of approximating things anecdotally with people saying that what they wanted was intimacy just in any way that they could get it. Because, you know, a child at the beginning consumes a lot of energy. So, you know, when I talk to couples, they would talk about the need, you know, to sustain their sex lives, more so that they just felt connected, because kids can, you know, sometimes subtract from, you know, the original bond. You're now, there's now three of you and then four of you, you know, so you want to make sure that you're still kind of a distinct entity as a couple.
But trying to get me time or us time for the couple together without the child, I mean, it sounds like it's a real guilt-laden concept for parents.
I know, and previous generations didn't feel that way. I think as women's workforce participation has increased, women have felt increasingly guilty about this, you know, and they've been sent this kind of plague of mixed messages about whether it's okay to work. I think Gallup's data from 2000, this is the most recent thing I could find on it, but I found it very fascinating. In 2000, record numbers of Americans thought that it was just fine if women were the primary breadwinners in families. They had no problem with that. But record numbers of Americans also thought that one parent should be home full-time with the kid or with the kids. So what does that say? I mean, that's plainly contradictory, because on the one hand, they're saying, oh, it's great that women are working. But on the other hand, they're saying someone's got to be home full-time all the time with children. So people feel very ambivalent about this, and no one, I think, is more torn apart about this than women are. So what I would hear all the time from women, everywhere I went, was I come home, I throw off my coat, and the first thing that I do is I get down on my hands and knees and I play with my kids. It's like this full saturation, immersion version of play, or bust, or nothing. So couple time really suffers as a result of this, because people feel like they've got to be compensating and spending more time with their kids. So as a result, couples now spend less time together than they did in the 1970s, about fewer hours per week than they did in, you know, the mid-70s. I think then it was like 12, and now it's about 9, when they're alone, completely alone, without the children.
Wow, that's a drop-off.
Yeah, it is. It's a significant drop-off.
You had mentioned earlier the concept of cultivating kids within an inch of their life. There's a whole chapter on that in this book called Concerted Cultivation. So we're long past the times then when we just let the kids go outside and play and, you know, be back for dinner. That was the real 60s kind of thing.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, that was my childhood, you know, sort of me getting on a bike, you know, going around the neighborhood and somebody banging a gong at 6 and telling me to come back in, basically. You know, but now, no, we don't do anything of the kind. And as I said, in large part, I think it's driven by a certain kind of economic anxiety, where we feel like unless we raise super children who are good at several zillion things, they don't stand a chance at going to a good college or getting a toehold in the same middle class that we've enjoyed. There are other things, too. You know, you talked about, you know, being sent outside. Parents are really reluctant to send their children outdoors. There's all sorts of amazing data about how few kids walk or bike to school now. And some of that is driven by an exaggerated fear of kidnapping, mm-hmm. and crime, even though crimes against kids are at an all-time low. Some of it is because, you know, our neighborhoods are kind of peculiar now. We now have these things called exurbs, where houses are very far apart, and there's a lot of sprawl. So finding the nearest child to play with is actually harder, you know, that you lose something when there's no more, when density is no longer a fact of your life. So that's a part of it. You know, indoor entertainments are a part of it. You know, there are now all sorts of indoor lures, like there's Netflix and video games and Facebook and all sorts of screen lures that keep kids inside. You know, so people are cultivating their kids in order to counterbalance all that stuff, too. Like, they're, you know, afraid of, you know, the lures of Facebook and texting and the, you know, I want to say the World of Warcraft. I'm now betraying how old and unhip I am, but I can't, don't even know what all these
can't go up with the names of the games.
That,
sure.
that I can't actually, yeah, right. When I have a teenager, I'll know everything. But, you know, yeah, I mean... So I think that parents are very self-consciously trying to program against that. So they drive their kids everywhere or sign their kids up for everything just so that they're not sitting on a couch. You know, there are lots of reasons.
But here again, I mean, it's, I forget which person it was who coined the term the overscheduled parent, because it's not just the kid who has to adhere to these schedules. It's the parent who has to drive them around to get
I coined
things.
That term.
Oh,
the
you
over- did. Yeah, the overscheduled child was, I think, it was Bill Dougherty, who's a social scientist in, you know, at the University of Minnesota, who's super smart and a polymath of sorts, and I can't remember if he coined it in like 1999 or 2000, but man, was he onto something.
Absolutely.
That came true. Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously some of parenting is exactly what it's been for eons, but it's just what our social structure in society turns it into that makes us feel, as some people do now, that it is in fact all joy and no fun.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of pressure kind of winds up landing on the nuclear family because of many of the things that I've described. You know, both parents are working, and then they come home and they find that they live further from their neighbors than they ever have. They find that they don't have a script for how to divide the chores, so they're fighting about it. And they find that they are living further away from their parents. You know, if they have a college education, they're not living near mom and dad.
Oh, true, true. So much has changed. All right. Thanks so much for joining us today, Jennifer Senior. The book is All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Take care. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about Ashland getting a gold star rating for bicycles. That's a change in its status. On our Vents Day segment, we'll talk about the dropping of Cover Oregon and oil trains crossing the region. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of the book, The ADHD Explosion. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant is Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Take care, stay cool, have a great day.